And yo, what is a cipher?
The strongest minds from every southern state came to Harlem.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to Sasha Jenkins. Sasha is a journalist, filmmaker, TV producer, author, musician, and all-around hip-hop polymath. He got his start chronicling graffiti and rap music in homemade zines before joining with a diverse crew of hip-hop obsessives to form the collective that came to be known as Ego Trip. That crew was responsible for a successful and influential magazine, two books, and multiple television projects, all of which explored music and race through a smart, funny, occasionally inflammatory lens. In addition to his work with Ego Trip and writing about hip-hop for basically every other outlet that covered it, Sasha has co-written Eminem's autobiography, The Way I Am, multiple books about graffiti, played in rock and hardcore bands, and has done so much more than we can fit in this introduction. His latest project is a documentary film about hip-hop fashion called Fresh Dressed, which came out in theaters earlier this year and recently aired on CNN. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoyed this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 64, where we talk to another great hip-hop journalist, the writer Dan Charnas. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com.
Hey, it's Josh with a reminder that if you want to get your hands on a limited edition Cipher t-shirt or hoodie, you only have until Tuesday, October 13th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Go to teespring.com/thecyphershow. That's teespring.com/thecyphershow to get yours before they're gone.
And now, here's Astoria's finest, Sasha Jenkins. I kind of wanted to start by talking about Queens, mm-hmm. since you have, you know, so much pride in Queens and your neighborhood particularly.
Regional pride.
So you came there in 77. Mm-hmm. You were, I don't know, 6, 7 years old, somewhere mm-hmm. around there. What struck you when you first got to Queens? Do you remember, like, something, you know, what was kind of like surprising?
I come from a really racially diverse family. I mean, ultimately, I'm black or whatever the fuck that means in America. But, you know, Chinese people in my family, Haitians, Jews, African-Americans. And so when I moved to Queens, I grew up across the street from the projects, and there was a weird, strange class divide, even though the building I lived in wasn't necessarily a housing project. It was HUD, which is government subsidized. It was literally across the street from the projects, same schools, pretty much no one had a dad. It was the same environment, you know, when crack hit, we just had a security guard in our building who smoked crack, you know, so it didn't really make that much of a difference. But I remember coming from Silver Spring, Maryland, where I lived in a similar kind of development that was probably subsidized, but it was a bit more mixed. You know, there were Ethiopians and, you know, nice white folk and African Americans, and, you know, everyone kind of lived in the same place. But when I moved to Queens, it was, you know, where are you from? What are you? You know, I didn't speak like everyone else. You know, I had a grandfather who was white, you know, who was Haitian, you know, born in Haiti, was Jewish, but was born in Haiti and didn't speak English. And so in the summertime, he'd sit on the benches out front and they'd be like, what are you, French? Like, I don't, you know, so I came from a very diverse background and I came to a neighborhood that was just, you were either black or white. And if you're white, you're some kind of ethnic white. And if you were black, there weren't many, quote unquote, ethnic blacks. It was mainly African-Americans. There weren't many Haitians in my neighborhood. So early on, just kind of looking at how I came from an environment that was very inclusive, that my world was kind of broad. You know, my father was a television producer and filmmaker. You know, My mother was a painter. So I came from this background that was very broad and was open to lots of ideas. And then I'm in this neighborhood where it's just like, what are you? Are you black, white? You talk funny. You know, I don't hang out with the white boys. I don't hang out with, you know, this one and that one. Everyone was very segregated in a weird way. So it was only natural that graffiti was something that I gravitated towards early on, because there were all kinds of kids into graffiti. It was the one thing in my neighborhood where the white kids and the black kids and the Latino kids, everyone kind of hung out. So that kind of environment felt very natural to me. And so that's kind of where I gravitated towards. And by the time, you know, 77, you know, I always tell the stories, it was like, you know, outside of my window right now, where there's this community garden where people are working on this community garden who are new to the community. That used to be the place where people sold crack. And it was also a park. And there would be DJs. These DJs called the Disco Twins,
right,
who were very well known before that. I guess they were called the N-Word Twins, who go back as far back as 73.
In spite of what KRS-One might have said in the Boogie Down Productions track South Bronx, hip-hop was definitely alive in Queens in the 70s. The scene was personified in the DJ team known as the Disco Twins, made up of Robert and Reggie Brown. Here's what the legendary Marley Marl had to say about them.
Everybody know the Disco Twins. These cats inspired me to come out, you know what I'm saying? I used to look up to these dudes. I couldn't even get in their parties. I remember when y'all had the flash party. I couldn't even get in.
They also performed with an MC, Corey D, under the group name Total Excitement. Although the Disco Twins did not become popular by producing records, they were some of the earliest DJs in hip-hop culture. They have performed with other pioneers such as Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force, the Treacherous Three, Cool DJ Herc, Cold Crush Brothers, and Crash Crew.
These guys were playing, you know, park jams right outside my window. And my mom, the Haitian lady, who was new to the neighborhood, was always the one who was calling the police. You know, it turns out they're the Disco Twins who, you ask Afrika Bambaataa or any of these guys who go way back, they'll tell you these guys were there early on. You know, all of these things that were proto-hip-hop or whatever, coming from a different place, coming from the background of someone who had a father who was a documentary filmmaker, who was African-American and from Philadelphia, and then having a mother from Haiti who was a painter who had a very distinct sort of Haitian artistic repertoire in terms of how she painted. I came into this neighborhood as an outsider, but also with eyes that were open to the possibilities and understanding why things might be important. Of course, I didn't know that hip-hop was going to be what it would go on to be, and I'm not saying that I was so deep as a kid that I knew that I was a document, you know, I was documenting early on. I mean, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that I was raised in a household where culture was paramount, and I understood the value of culture. And so I went from Silver Spring, Maryland, where, you know, we rode skateboards and, you know, that was like the second wave of skateboarding. You know, my sister was 6 years older than me. She had a skateboard. I rode a skateboard. There was a swimming pool there. Apparently, Tommy Davidson is from that same complex, and he knew my dad because Tommy was trying to make it in showbiz, and my dad was the local guy who was a television producer, and people knew him. But I came, you know, Rock Creek Park, you know, immortalized in the song, was down the block from me, you know, beautiful park. I went from that kind of environment to New York City in the late 70s, which was, you know, on the verge of bankruptcy, and my mother would get mugged all the time. It was a different time. And I just was different. But there was so much adventure. I lived down the block from the East River. You know, we played in the river. There was just so many things that we did then that kids don't do now because they're so stuck on technology and their phones. I mean, we would go to different places. And that wasn't something that you did back then because kids stayed in their own neighborhoods. But through graffiti got me out of my neighborhood, and it got me to understand politics, and it got me to understand, well, this kid is white and he's from this neighborhood. And if you have a problem with him, you might not want to go over there because you'll stick out like a sore thumb. But then you become friends with him, and next thing you know, his mother knows you. And so graffiti and my interest in graffiti really opened me up. Or it really connected with who I was in terms of how I was raised. And it kind of kept me in touch with all of the things that I would go on to be interested in, and was a reflection of who I was at my core. And, you know, I tell people all the time now, it's like graffiti is all about ego, right? And so for a lot of graffiti writers, many of them in their 40s and 50s and 60s, they'll tell you, well, if you weren't king of the line, or if, you know, this guy didn't do that much graffiti, it's like, that's not what it's really about, because there's only a handful of guys who are kings. You know what I mean? You need serfs. You need foot soldiers. You know, like,
no. Otherwise, being king, to what are you king of?
Yeah, you're king of nothing. You know, so I look at graffiti as almost like skateboarding. It's like, not everyone can be a professional skateboarder, but a lot of kids have skateboards. So I was a kid who had a marker and spray paint, and my fascination with that and my explorations into that culture opened a lot of doors for me. And that's what I learned in Queens. You know, my mother told me to go outside and play, and I did, and everyone had magic markers, and these kids were writing on the slide. You know, I wanted to slide down the slide, and these kids were writing on the slide. And I'm like, what are you doing? I'm going to mess up my clothes. And guy gave me a magic marker and explained to me what it was. And it made sense to me to a certain extent, because my house was filled with paint. My mom was a painter, you know, so I understood the value of using colors to express yourself. And so, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but
yeah,
you're going to make me cry.
There are a bunch of things in that answer I'm going to go back to, but one of them is you've been a, you know, strong advocate for Queens's place in early hip hop history. You were talking about the Disco Twins, things like that. You know, we've had other people on, Derek Angeletti for one, who kind of shares that, you know, that interest. What, which, other than the Disco Twins, like, which Queens figures do you remember from your childhood who, you know, never really got their due as compared to some of the Bronx people?
Well, first of all, if we flash forward a little bit further and just talk about production, hip hop production.
There's Larry Smith.
Well, there's Larry Smith, but even to me, I learned recently, a few years ago, I was talking to Marley Marl, and he pointed out to me, he's like, you know, the first track I ever made, I made in your building. And that wasn't in Queensbridge. That was in my building. There was a jazz musician who lived on the first floor who had a four track. And he, you know, he recorded the song with Dimples D, that I Will Survive. His first song, Marley Marl's first song he produced in my building. And to me, it's like Marley is one of the greatest producers of all time, one of the most influential producers of all time. You know, to tell me he paid the guy $75 to use the four track, you know? And I remember as a kid, like, yeah, this guy so-and-so is like a musician. I didn't understand. I'm not even clear on who he is or who he was. But when Marley told me, like, there have been a lot of weird things in my life that, you know, I'm not going to, I believe in something greater than me that I don't understand. I can't necessarily attach it to a particular faith, but like Marley making his first track in my building says something about who I became. And it, to me, it's kind of like a message for like how powerful the mind is. But that, let's just say that's just a random occurrence. When I was in high school, flashing forward a little bit further, a good friend of mine named Chaka, who's been in a bunch of bands, including Orange 9mm and a band called Burn, hardcore band. We went to the same high school together, and he was cutting class, and I had a substitute teacher. And back in those days, it's like, you take the whole, you know, I'm going to the bathroom. You know, maybe he wasn't even cutting class. He asked for the hall pass to go to the bathroom. He saw that I was in this class. It was a music class. It was a guitar class, and my teacher was absent. So he comes in, and me, him, and this kid, Skinhead Randy, were talking about hardcore. And this must have been 1986, and the substitute teacher overheard us talking about hardcore and particularly the Bad Brains. And the substitute teacher came over and said, hey, I produced the first Bad Brains record. And we're like, yeah, whatever. So my friend Chaka said, come in with that record tomorrow and I'll give you $25. Don't you know, the guy came in with the record. He used to be in a band called The Dots, and he produced Stay Close to Me, Pay to Come, first Bad Brains record. Now, when you think about, flashing back a little bit to my relationship with Chaka, we met in high school because one of us had a black book.
Black books, also known as peace books, were sketchbooks used by graffiti artists. They were frequently passed along from writer to writer and often ended up becoming records of the scene at the time. As we discussed later in the interview, in recent years, Sasha has ended up curating sketches in different piece books from throughout the history of graffiti to create a series of art books. We also discussed these piece books in episode 79 with Lisa Leone.
Turns out he was a graffiti writer too. He wasn't really into skateboarding yet. I was into skateboarding. He was into hardcore. I was a black dude who had an older sister. We lived in Maryland. She listened to Foreigner and she listened to Jimi Hendrix, you know, and I would dig through her records when she wasn't around. So I liked rock. So he turned me on to hardcore and I turned him on to skateboarding. It turns out that his dad, you know, his dad was a photographer, an African-American photographer who knew my dad. Because at that time, there was but a small circle of, you know, African-Americans who were doing stuff like that in the media. So I meet this kid randomly in high school through a black book. We become friends. It turns out our fathers knew each other. I turn him on to skateboarding. He turns me on to hardcore. He makes me a mixtape, 40 bands on it. And I kept asking him, I was like, who is this right here? What is this? He's like, it's the Bad Brains. And we, you know, we'd always talk. I'd be like, yo, this is some real white. The hardcore thing is cool, but it's like real white. I don't know if I feel comfortable. He's like, yo, Bad Brains are black. And I liked a lot of the music on that mixtape that he made me, but the Bad Brains like stuck out. Like,
yeah.
And I was like, what record is this? He's like, Eye Against Eye. I was like, do you have it? He's like, yeah. I was like, all right, sell it to me. He's like, I don't want to sell you my record. I was like, come on, sell me the record. He's like, all right, it's going to cost you $10. So I remember going to his house and buying the record from him, and it was all beat up and scratched up. And it was Eye Against Eye. And then you flash forward years later, somehow I'm in a band with Daryl.
Daryl Jennifer.
In my life, in terms of things I've been, you know, and then I can bring it to graffiti, talk about Subway Art, a book that was highly influential in general.
Subway Art is a book by Henry Chalfon and Martha Cooper. Originally published in 1984, the collection of photographs of graffiti is credited with helping to spread graffiti and hip-hop culture all over the world. The book was reissued in a special 25th anniversary edition in 2009.
And I remember going to the same crappy junior high that Nas went to, and having an art teacher who said to me, graffiti seems cool. As long as you don't give me a hard time, stay in the back of the class, I'll give you an A. You know, just assuming that I was going to give him a hard time. So he let me stay in the back of the class, and I had Subway Art. And I would look at Subway Art, and I would doodle, and I would draw, and I would do all these things. Years later, when it was time for me, I wanted to start a graffiti zine. You know, I was completely inspired by. So through hardcore, there was a whole scene of zines, right? So I was fascinated by zines. When I was a kid, I was really into Look magazine and Life magazine, and there were these, back in the 70s, you would order like Life, Time Life, these sort of compilation books that had like the best photography from World War II in the 60s. And my parents had a couple of these books. And when I was a kid, I would just look at, you know, shots from D-Day or the soldiers in the beach on the sand dead, you know, all these really iconic Iwo Jima, all these really iconic photographs. I was into books and magazines. And so getting into hardcore, learning about zines, being really into it, meeting kids who made zines, and then discovering IGT, Phase 2 zine, him and David Schmidlap, and really being inspired by the zine that they did. My friend Chaka winds up doing a compilation called the New Breed Compilation. And for people who know hardcore, it's a pretty influential compilation, and it was a cassette tape that came along with a booklet, and they put it in a plastic, you know, like a comic book plastic. Mm-hmm. And when he did that, it was a zine, and it had, Chaka was a graffiti artist, so he did some graffiti in it. It was really cool. And I said to Chaka, like, who's your printer? You know, I want to do a graffiti zine like that. And simultaneously, I wrote a letter to Phase 2, and I said, you know, IGT is a huge inspiration to me. Like, I want to do this. You know, I want to do a magazine too. And Phase 2 wrote me like a 6-page handwritten letter with the wow. most amazing hand style, basically telling me, go for yours, kid. Do it. You can do it.
So I can't imagine getting a message like that from someone of that stature. Like, that's
yeah.
been incredible.
And so I got that letter, and then Chaka hooked me up with his printer, and I went to my mother and I said, I need $800, which for my mother was a lot of money. I was like, And she's like, what do you want $800 for? And I was like, I want to do this magazine. I really need $800. I don't know where she got it from. She got me the $800. And in 1988, I published a zine called Graphic Scenes in Explicit Language. After I published the zine, there's a store right now in West Broadway called The Scrapyard that sells graffiti-related supplies. Before that, it was called Soho Zat, and it was across the street, which is currently a Korean deli. And that was where you would go to buy your graffiti zines at the time. And at the time, there was IGT, a magazine called Ghetto Art out of California. Same time that I came out, Steve Powers did something called On the Go, which would go on to be a more established zine. And it was also an interesting area because around the block was Henry Chalfant's studio. And so you would go to Soho Zat to get your magazines and meet writers. And it was also a head shop and they sold markers. And then you go up the block and make a right and you would knock on Henry's door hoping that he would let you in and show you photographs. So a friend of mine's like, let's go to Henry's and knock on the door. I was like, I was nervous. I was scared. So we knock on the door and it wasn't Henry. It was this guy named Carl Weston who did a video series called Videograph, which is also highly influential. And I wound up getting involved with Videograph as well. And Videograph was the first video magazine created by graffiti writers for graffiti writers documenting, you know, J.A. writing on police cars.
I was going to say, I saw that clip last night, actually. Mm-hmm. That was a wild, insane clip. I mean, for people who haven't seen it, it's literally him writing fuck the and leaving police on the police car.
So why you do this, man?
Why I do this?
Tell me.
It's fun. It's a good time. I do it basically for the enjoyment of others. I feel that it's a public access service, just like Channel J.
And then also writing on the token booth clerk's window with the token booth clerk in the token booth. So I met Carl at that time. He was 5 or 6 years older than me. I was with a friend who was about his age, so they became kind of closer friends. But then eventually me and Carl became really good friends, and then I wound up becoming a producer on Videograph and a personality on Videograph.
Yo, I hit your mother with a power pellet.
Hey, man.
Yo, you want to do mother jokes too?
Yeah, yeah.
You rolling?
Yeah.
Yo, man, what up? My name is Sasha. Yo, I hit your mother with a power pellet like Pac-Man. She said waka waka. You know what I'm saying? Waka waka. Big Black Mac with no seeds on my bun. Chucking spears to stun. Run, Frosty, run to your unique cave, shelter from the sun. Want to step to me? That can be fun.
And then eventually, I met Henry. And Henry wound up producing a documentary called Flying Cut Sleeves, which is about gangs in the South Bronx.
They tried to take over one of my division, but they didn't quite make it, and we killed two of their guys. They tried to burn down my clubhouse. We killed two of their guys. And five of their guys rolled up on one of the Savage Nomads. You know what they told them? Oh, we're going to give you hell, baby. We're going to give you hell. And they didn't even kill them.
And I was 17, and I wound up being a production assistant on that film. So flash forward to now, I do a film called Fresh Dressed, and a very important figure in the film, this woman, Laureen Padilla, who was a former gang member, I interviewed her for my film.
This all began with that movie, Easy Rider. A lot of people won't admit it, but it is the truth. You know, people saw that. That gave you the sense of outlaw.
And she remembered me from when I was a kid and said, I agree to do this interview. So flashback a little bit further back, but fairly recently, you know, me and Henry did a book called Training Days. You know, being a fan of subway art, you know, you love the images and you love the pictures, but I felt like it would be great to hear from these people, you know, what the experience was like, to kind of fill in a lot of blanks for people who weren't there. I mean, that era is completely gone. So I've gone on to collaborate with people who were inspirations to me. And I was able to find people who inspired me, who I was able to learn from. And that's the kind of the through line, whether it's Phase Two or Henry Chalfant or Daryl Jennifer, you know, people I admired greatly, whose art inspired me. And I was somehow able to weasel my way into their lives and not only learn from them, but collaborate with them. So there you go.
Yeah. Another part of the graffiti, you know, your whole history with graffiti is obviously the Peace Book series you did with Chino.
Mm-hmm.
What inspired you to start the series and why did you format it the way you did? For people who haven't seen it, it's literally, you know, reproductions of Peace Book pieces, no text except for an introduction, no page numbers even. So you kind of have to look in the back and, you know, go almost page by page through the whole thing. You know, what inspired you to do it and why format it the way you did?
There's been a lot of these graffiti books over the years. I'd written a few books, or, you know, Ego Trip, we had done a few books. And I always want to do stuff that kind of pushes the envelope. I mean, if you're not doing something that's different, then there's no need to do it. And I knew that, like, drawing is one of the key, you know, most people think that, like, who don't know anything about graffiti, it's like, yeah, these kids, these blacks and Puerto Ricans are just out here. You know, there's no, the people don't know that there's a science behind it. People don't know it's a very personal art form. People don't know that people who are the artists develop their style. People don't understand. The other important thing was, because of technology, right, the learning curve, it's a lot easier to learn now. If you're like an artistically inclined kid who's interested in graffiti, there are special caps made, you know, now that cater to whether it's going to be fat or skinny. When I was coming up, you'd have to steal the oven cleaner cap in the supermarket and put it on your spray can to make it really wide and thin, you know, Jif foam or whatever, you know. So I'd realized that the science of graffiti had really evolved. Some people don't like the term graffiti, particularly Phase Two. He feels like it's derogatory. So the proper term is writing for many people. So the art of writing, technology had really had an influence on where it was going now, because back then you typically would have a master that you were an apprentice to. And that person would sit you down with a book and show you stuff, and or you'd be privy to that master's books. So you can study. Other than having the books or having photographs, the stuff was moving on the train. So it's like really hard. Like, how can you study the work of a master if it's constantly moving? So peace books were one of the most important elements of the culture that had been overlooked. And I felt that creating a book that was true to form, true to the essence of where, you know, where it all came from, would be an important document, an important historical document. So we wound up, for the first one, finding stuff that went as far back as 1973. First book was stuff from 73 that went all the way up to 1987. Second book was like 87 to 2005. And then the final book was called World Peace Book, which had drawings from all over the world, which just shows you how far the culture has traveled. And, you know, a lot of people who are initiated in the culture would get the book and, like, wouldn't even know that it wasn't, it felt so real. The first one, we didn't have bleed throughs, you know, so that the first one, we were learning what we were doing. Mm-hmm. The second one, we would scan both sides. So,
you know, okay.
Yeah. The other ones, it bleeds through. So it really has the feel. I mean, the first one is cool, but the other ones really have that feel of, like, what it looks and smells and tastes like. Mm-hmm. And we felt it was important. I mean, Chino was someone who, again, someone I looked up to. Ironically, we didn't get along. How we met the first time was under some really suspect circumstances. But, you know, I charged that up to the game. It's just graffiti. It's just, it is what it is. But years later, we became good friends. And I'm just thinking about it now. Like, Chino is someone who was all city. I saw his name everywhere. I knew who he was. He was a celebrity when I was a kid. He's not that much older than me. But he was way more advanced than me in the world of graffiti. You know, I was just, he's definitely not a toy. He's someone who's put in work. And so he's an example of someone else, actually, who I've admired, and I've somehow weaseled my way into his life. And for instance, tomorrow we have an event called the Burning of Kingston, you know, upstate New York at the Trolley Museum. It's the only place in the world where you can legally paint an authentic New York City subway car. And two teams of guys who aren't necessarily in the same crew are battling it out on the side of a subway train. It's the second year we've done it. So, yeah, graffiti.
Yeah. So you've written a lot about the writer's bench at 149th Street. Did you ever go there, or was that kind of before your time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I told you I'd gone to the writer's bench when it was popping, I'd be a liar. So, no.
Okay.
No. I mean, it's legendary. And you know, I could relate to it in that where I grew up in Queens, which the double R train at the time, now it's the N line, it was called the double R, we would go to the layup, and that was the middle track where they parked the trains, and we would hang out there. We would bench, which means you'd sit on the bench and you walk watch trains go by. Now, 149th Street, that train line, that was the elite line. That's where some of the great masters did their best work, and that's why it was a really respected place. But by the time I was in full swing writing, graffiti was kind of on the way. It was kind of dying, you know, and all those great masters, you know, that period is between like 81 and 83 or 79, and 83, that was like a really rich period for the writer's bench. But after that, by the time I was really anything, you know, 84, 85, writer's bench wasn't anything. I was in Queens. I was a local Queens writer. I wasn't even sophisticated enough at that point to even know about the writer's bench.
Yeah. You know, you did this story about Speck and his passing.
In his 2002 article, The Writing on the Wall, Graffiti Culture Crumbles into the Violence It Once Escaped, Sasha wrote about the death of 19-year-old graffiti writer Timothy Speck Falzone, who was allegedly shot and killed by a rival writer, an incident, Sasha wrote, that shook the graffiti world.
And you mentioned it, how the graffiti apprenticeship system you were talking about was essentially destroyed in the early 90s once the MTA took huge steps to stop bombing trains. What effect did that system going away have on graffiti and on the people who did it?
Well, for me, it was like a rite of passage. It was a neighborhood thing. I mean, even my sister, who wasn't a graffiti writer, had a tag and knew how to write her name in a particular way. It was just something that all the kids did. I blame it on crack. I blame it on heavy drugs. You know, I think in my neighborhood, particularly with African-American kids, you know, once crack hit, kids were looking at me like, you still do that? Like, I'm getting money. Like, I'm getting $1,500 a day selling crack to these crackers. Like, you're writing graffiti for no why. It doesn't make any sense. You know, so this hyper-consumerism that kind of syncs up with the rise of hip-hop, graffiti, I wasn't going to be able, you know, unless I was teaching some kid, you know, by 1984, like, no one cared about graffiti in my neighborhood. But I had learned from... Someone physically gave me a magic marker. And I think once that chain was broken, you know, I think it still remained vital in a lot of Latino communities and a lot of, you know, a lot of white kids, you know, kind of kept the tradition going. But in my neighborhood, at least the 4-block radius where I lived, it was largely African American, and graffiti was just kind of like, you're stupid for still doing it. There's no money in it. It's not even cool. But having a mentor and having someone over you who can show you some things was a crucial part of my development. And there were people who I looked up to, who I aspired to be like and or meet. And that combination of the MTA cracking down on graffiti as well and making the penalties more stiff, the intelligence community becoming more sophisticated. I mean, you had cops who had been well-versed on graffiti since 1973, who knew the ins and outs and had studied these kids. But by 1987, there were so many other things that could occupy a kid's mind. Even technology slowly creeping up might have had a hand in it, but it just wasn't considered cool anymore, and the risks weren't, you know, the penalties were more stiff. So, like, the average guy who was your mentor, at this point, he's 21, he's like, I'm not risking my shit for this. For what? You know, the trains don't even run that long, fewer train lines. It's just like, why am I going to bust my ass doing this? And then painting murals and walls wasn't super popular at the time. So without mentors, it definitely had a hand in kind of the culture slipping away. And one of the last sort of bits of like connecting to that history were the peace books, because people would still pass them around. Even guys who weren't even writing anymore, who were really good, the younger folks who were fans of their work would say, hey, can you do this piece for me? And that kind of kept a lot of folks who were out of the culture, like, kind of connected to it still.
I wanted to jump ahead a little bit to Ego Trip, to your time there.
The hip-hop magazine Ego Trip, co-founded by Sasha, began in 1994 and lasted for 4 years. You can find selected parts of their archives at egotripland.com.
For a magazine that didn't publish that many issues, 13 issues or something, it was really influential. And one of the things that was most influential about it was its voice, you know, kind of irreverent. It wasn't like, you know, the cushy celebrity interviews. It wasn't like dispassionate pseudo-journalism or whatever. It was something very different. How would you describe the Ego Trip voice?
Well, we call ourselves the arrogant voice of musical truth, which I guess I came up with. I don't really know what that means. I describe Ego Trip as a band, right? And a band puts out really great albums for a very particular reason, for a very particular time. And we all came from very diverse backgrounds. Me and Elliot had the most in common in that we were both from Queens and we both went to the same high school. Elliot's background, you know, his mom is Greek and Ecuadorian. His dad's African-American. You know, he grew up in the Woodside Projects. He loved hip hop, you know, Jeff Chairman Mao, you know, from Massachusetts. I first met him when I was interning at a place called Third World Newsreel. And I was in my teens, you know, dubbing Black Panther Party documentaries for universities that wanted to, you know, screen the stuff for their kids. And no, maybe I met Mao in like 91, and they knew I was into graffiti and hip hop, and they kept saying, hey, there's this guy, you know, who we know who's a filmmaker who's really into hip hop, you know, Chinese guy, his name is Jeff Mao, like, you should meet him. And then one day I'm in the elevator and I see a Chinese guy with a Carhartt jacket and I'm like, you're Jeff, right? And he was like, yeah. I was like, I heard so much about you, man. Like, you know, but Mao is like a DJ and a vinyl nut and a fan of history and culture and like dives deep, you know? So we hit it off. And then I didn't even really know Elliot in high school. Long story how we connected, but I was, before Ego Trip, I was doing something called Beatdown, which was a hip-hop newspaper that I started with a guy named Haji Akibide, who I grew up with in Queens, who was a producer who worked with Marley Marl. Anyway, we started a hip-hop newspaper, and Elliot was writing for us at the time. So that's how I knew Elliot. I got to know Elliot, and Elliot was like a real hip-hop nut, had lots of vinyl, went to Rock and Soul, collected vinyl like crazy, and loved hip-hop. And then Brent Rollins and Gabe Alvarez were running Rap Pages in California, and they reached out to us because they had a column called Underground Zine, and then they wrote about our zine, Ego Trip, and then we just kicked it with Elliot. Me and Elliot kicked it with Gabe, and then Gabe was nice enough to assign us stuff for Rap Pages. So the next thing you know, myself, Mao, and Elliot are writing for Rap Pages, and then we got the opportunity to interview Cypress Hill right around the time of the quote-unquote L.A. riots. And this is back when the label would, oh, you're doing a cover story? All right, we'll pay for you guys to fly out and da-da-da. Like, I didn't even have a driver's license. I'd only been to California once. It was like, shit, we're going to go. The label's going to pay for us? Great. So we go there. I mean, I'll just tie it up really quick. And then Elliot was supposed to interview Cypress Hill. And they're like, you guys get high? And we were both like, no. And then B-Real's like, well, one of you motherfuckers are going to smoke with Cypress Hill today. So Elliot, I'm like, yo, I'm not doing it. So Elliot just takes one hit. And he was the guy who was supposed to interview, and he just falls asleep. And so I wound up interviewing, you know, Cypress. And it was a cool interview. It was off freestyle, just me asking them, oh, gangs, you know, whatever. You know, I'm from New York. Tell me about, why is it so crazy out here? And then during that trip, we really connected with Gabe. We connected with Brent Rollins. We connected with a photographer named Brian Cross, B+, who's written some amazing books in his own right. And then we became friends with Gabe and Brent. And then it was like, hey, Gabe, like, we're trying to do this Ego Trip thing. Why don't you move to New York? And we didn't really have much money. And Gabe moved to my mom's house in Queens. And so he moves out and becomes a serious soldier and one of the most powerful. To me, Gabe's my, to me, Gabe's the funniest and smartest, most creative guy on the team. I think he's just, the guy's brilliant. So Gabe comes out
And then so the team is starting to formulate, and Brent is a graphic designer. He's just clearly one of the best, advanced, a brilliant dude. He eventually says, you know what, I want to come to New York and do my own thing too, and let's do Ego Trip. And so that's kind of how the Voltron formed. And it was all about the diversity. You know, Mao being, you know, Asian from Massachusetts, you know, son of educators, you know, Brent Rollins, his dad was like my dad. I think his dad was a filmmaker and television producer at a time when there weren't many, you know, African-Americans doing that. And then his mom was Vietnamese. So Brent is black and Vietnamese. And then, you know, Gabe's Mexican, you know, from L.A. And then I am what I am, you know. And so it was such a unique combination of really interesting, kind of weird, disconnected people coming together and connecting on something they're really passionate about. And people ask me about Ego Trip sometimes, and I'm just like, I can't really explain it. All I can say is, as someone who's a fan of bands like Stooges, you know, first record's really cool. Then your man James came on, you know what I mean? And it just, he just took it to another level. And Ego Trip was cool before those guys came on. But once Brent and Gabe came on, it just, it took whatever talent and idea we had to a whole other level. And so Ego Trip, without everyone doing what they did, it would not have been what some people think it went on to become.
At a certain point, did you start noticing biters? You know what I mean?
This guy, you're trying to hype me up. I mean, here's the interesting thing. Like, simultaneously while we were doing Ego Trip, Elliot wound up being the music editor at The Source, and I wound up being the music editor at Vibe. And so we couldn't pay people. So it'd be like, yeah, write for Ego Trip, and, you know, Elliot will throw you a couple of reviews at The Source, and I'll throw you a couple of whatever's at Vibe. And so we kind of used the system to kind of, we were like a farm team for all these other, you know, bigger publications, and a lot of people came through our doors. Were there biters? I mean, it's hard to say, because we had such an influence from behind the scenes because we were doing our own magazine, yet many of us who came through us were now having an influence at all these other places. So, you know, on the go, for instance, people come up to me like, yeah, I love your magazine. They'll talk to me for 20 minutes. And then I'll be like, wait a minute, you're talking about On the Go. You're not talking about Ego Trip. And I would say, like, on the go, there were a lot of comparisons, but I go back to saying Steve Powers was publishing magazines when I was doing my zine. So I look at, you know, Steve Powers is like my cousin. You know what I mean? Like, we were in a family business at a time when there weren't a lot of people like us. And his sensibility, you know, he's from Philly. He's a white dude. He likes punk. He loves graffiti. You know, the way he saw the world at that time was advanced. You know, this is before the internet. He was a guy plugged into culture and also had a sense of humor.
So there are going to be similarities.
There are going to be some similarities. But if you know, the only real similarity is just like really flamboyant / great design. Ari Foreman is a great designer, and their sense of humor. Our sense of humor is similar in some ways, but very different in other ways. And I think that we invested probably more time in being very critical of records and writing more thoughtfully about records. They did the same, but I think humor was a larger part of what they did. And also with us, race was a big part of what it was we did, which separated us from them. Again, because we come from such diverse backgrounds and we're all of color, it put us in a unique position to be able to comment and have a perspective on a lot of different things that other people could. I mean, other people, you couldn't cast a better crew of guys coming together to do stuff.
Yeah, and you were able to do great stuff on race. Obviously, the Big Book of Racism, which was just this insane thing. The stuff you guys say and kind of get away with, I think it comes, you're able to do it, I think, because of what you were talking about, of how diverse the crew is and the place you're coming from, that stuff, you know, from another angle might be offensive, is just kind of becomes part of the voice and part of the humor.
Yeah, and I think it was important to have, a lot of times things are very black and white, you know, so, you know, I can talk from a Haitian perspective, I can talk from an African-American perspective, and
Elliot can talk from an African-American perspective. And these are perspectives that we know well, and I hope we continue to know them well. But having Mal and Brent and Gabe also gave a really modern kind of take on the conversation about race. Because it's always, you know, white people going at the black people and vice versa. It's like Asians too, you know, Blasians, you know, Brent might be described as a Blasian, you know, Blasians too, you know, Mexicans too, you know, and you look at what's going on in the world and you look at what's going on in America, like we were kind of early to a lot of, you know, Gabe, Mal, Brent, those guys are all real strong voices. And I think their perspective made Ego Trip what it was, which was using hip hop as a platform to talk about a lot of bigger picture issues. And what is hip hop? Hip hop is a reflection of the environment and the climate. Hip hop is the dozens making fun of people. Hip hop is insecurity. Hip hop is the byproduct of oppression. You know, hip hop is all of those things. It's the blues. It's having a new pair of sneakers and feeling good about it. It's all those things. And I think that, you know, two guys from California, one guy from Massachusetts, and two guys from Queens, all of color with such diversity, that's what made us, you know, something different.
And you did the White Rapper Show, which is a pretty wild program.
So we're going to search the nation, choose 10 white MCs, and ship them to the South Bronx.
South Bronx. South, South Bronx.
Here in the birthplace of hip-hop, their love and knowledge of the culture will be put to the test.
You better come with the heat.
Along the way, they'll get schooled by hip-hop heavyweights.
Just Blaze.
Gotta have passion.
But only if you put everything into it, is it gonna work for you, you dig?
They'll get a chance to prove their lyrical prowess.
I'm like a prodigy and I'm here to teach you. Your little deaf daughter say, Daddy, why he beat you?
And fight to stay in the game.
What was that like to create? Like, what were you kind of thinking about when you guys put that show together?
Well, we had done the Big Book of Racism, and at that point, I'm not saying our interest in hip-hop was starting to fade, but, you know, we were getting older and thinking about the bigger picture at that point. And, you know, race was something that wasn't going away. So we wanted to combine. We had already done these other shows at VH1. We did a series called Race-A-Rama, which was, you know, these sort of VH1-style talking head shows where we explored race. We had a show called Dude, Where's My Ghetto Pass, which was about, like, where do white people fit into all this? There was a show called In Race We Lust, which talked about, you know, sexuality and race and how it's all tied into. And then there was a show called Blackophobia, which is about a lot of people, including black people, being afraid of black people and discussing things that people weren't comfortable discussing. So that was a three-part series. So after we had done that, VH1 was like, you know, we love working with you guys. You know, what do you guys want to do? And it was like a few days before Christmas, and they took us out for drinks, and I was really drunk. And I said, we should do a show called The White House, where we make white kids move to the South Bronx and learn about hip-hop. And they said, that's fucking great. Let's do it. And that's how it happened.
That was the genesis of
that was it.
The White Rapper Show. Yeah.
Yeah, we had done these great race-related shows. They liked, you know, Jim Ackerman, who's a friend still to this day, and was a big advocate for Ego Trip, was a high-powered man at VH1 and said, let's do this. So we did the White Rapper Show. All the stuff leading up to it, again, we were older. We were, you know, hip-hop was changing. We wanted to find creative ways to continue to do what we did and push what we were doing forward into new arenas. And so we started casting the show, and we realized that, you know, we wanted to make something that was a reflection of the conversation that white people have in hip hop. It wasn't really, you know, I tell this story all the time. Like, you know, I did Eminem's biography, and I was in a basement I was at his house in Detroit, and we're doing what we're doing right now. I'm interviewing him. We're having a conversation. Just out of nowhere, he said, you know what I hate? Like, what is it? I fucking hate the White Rapper Show. I hate that shit. And I just let him talk for like 5 minutes, just went on and on about how he hated it. I was like, yo, you know, I created that show, right? He was like, no. And I was like, don't you get the joke? He's like, it's not funny. I was like, don't you get it though, bro? It's like, you changed the game. Like, even at that point when we did the show, you know, Eminem was huge. You know, sure, there was still discussion about white rappers, but it was starting to fade. I was like, you changed the game. I was like, you understand many of us, I didn't know that white people were poor outside of the Waltons. I didn't know white people were poor.
I didn't know why people were dysfunctional on that level. You came out and represented a voice that people could recognize was true to who you were. And you weren't trying to be something that you weren't. I was like, that is the power of who you are and what you've done. And the White Rapper Show was finding kids from around the country who really believed in hip hop and represented themselves in a very particular way. And we put them in an environment where they had conversations. And then they had to interact with the people who created hip hop, the people who inspired hip hop. They had to perform. And they were learning about the culture. And I said, because of your popularity, going back to my connection earlier about technology and graffiti and how people can skip steps, I was like, you learn this shit. Like, you love Master Ace, you know? And I love Master Ace too, and he's still out here doing it. But, you know, a lot of kids might not know Master Ace the way you did, M. You were a student of the culture. And so you changed the way that people, at least people I know, see what, quote unquote, white rappers. It's like, it's just kind of a joke. White rappers just sounds silly in itself. But we did the show, and it was really a conversation amongst white people about their place in hip hop. And at the same time, a lot of these folks had talent and wanted to make it. And, you know, there was a $100,000 prize, you know, for the winner. And that show wouldn't happen. These, you know, no one's trying to give anybody $100,000 for rapping. So it was a real win for us. And it was a real learning experience because we weren't the production company. We did it with Ken Mock, who does America's Next Top Model. You know, they paired us with, you know, folks in Hollywood. And Ken Mock, you know, he got the job because he was Asian. He's also good, but we're like, it's rare that we get opportunities like this. And here's an Asian man who's in Hollywood doing his thing. Like, Mao, you agree with this? You're Chinese. Like, this is good. You know, let's work and network with people who are like us, who can understand where we're from. I mean, he had plenty of white folks working for him and plenty of black folks. But, you know, knowing that the head of the production company was Asian meant something to us for sure. And that's why we agreed to go with him. And it was a real learning experience for us, you know, getting to do the casting and like figuring out the scenarios, working with set designers. I mean, it was a real and then actually being in the South Bronx, you know, finding a warehouse, cleaning it out, getting great graffiti artists like Days and Sharp and T-Kid, you know, painting the interior and exteriors of the building. I remember I was driving to the set and I saw a license plate that said Teen TMT, T-E-A-N-T-M-T. And Teen was a legendary graffiti writer. So I pulled up next to him. I was like, yo, are you Teen? TMT, is that you? You're really Teen? He's like, yeah, why? I was like, yo, come to this address. Come to this address. All these writers are going to be there. Come through. Trust me. I'm not crazy. You're Teen. You're not fronting, right? Because why would anyone else have this license plate?
Right.
Come see me. So I tell Days and all these guys, yo, I ran into Teen, TMT. They're like, really? I haven't seen that guy in years. He shows up. And it's like, holy shit, it's Teen TMT. And he's here. And he's like, what is all this? And I'm like, yo, it's a television show called The White Rapper Show. And I'm one of the executive producers and creators of the show. And it's about hip hop. Catch a tag. Teen, you know, welcome. You know, so amazing experiences like that. And then getting to work with Brand Nubian and all these, you know, artists that, you know, we admired and respected, and giving them a platform to have some things to say about hip hop and actually teach people.
Sure. And to be kind of multidimensional, right? And not just the scowling rapper. Like,
right.
Obviously, you know, Jamar is pretty funny on it. Like, a lot of people are pretty,
right.
You know, get to show multiple sides of their personality.
Right. I mean, Jamar asking, like, who's this ghetto revival dude? Like, it's like, why would you want to, you know, to John Brown, who's a great guy, and he's my guy still, you know, like, who wants to, why would you want to revive the ghetto?
The ghetto is poverty and pain, especially for black people.
I want to revive economically, spiritually, you know what I'm saying? Infrastructure-wise, it's nothing but love, my brother.
When I hear ghetto revival, I'm thinking that y'all trying to bring ghetto back. Like, y'all want pissing in elevators and smoking crack and like that. Like,
nah, man. Hallelujah, holla back. Hallelujah, holla back.
Holler who you holler back.
Okay, what the f- is that?
You know what I mean, this is a very valid question. And if you ask John Brown that question now, he might not have the same answers he had years ago. But it was a valid question. And that's all we wanted to do, man, was like create conversation around hip hop and have a little fun. And so I think the show is reflective of the DNA of Ego Trip, which is nerding out on history and culture, having our facts together, wanting to say something, and then having fun with it, being funny, having fun. That was what we were about.
So just the other day, I was watching an interview with CNN, the rappers, not the mm-hmm. TV network.
Oh, okay. I'd love to clear this up.
Yeah. So they said that you did a story on them in 97.
Right.
And they really wanted to appear to be like super gangster.
Right.
And so they put a bunch of fake coke on the table, a bunch of real guns.
Right.
And the way they tell it is they accidentally let off a shot indoors.
Right.
But because they were playing these super gangster characters, even though they're freaking out, they had to pretend to be like cool about it. Like it just happened every day.
Yo, me and Pone one day, we got interviewed by Sasha Jenkins, right? And this is when we first started. Capone, we got the guns in there and shit. But we were emulating N.W.A. We wanted Sasha Jenkins to have this experience like N.W.A. So Pone pulls out the joint. All I hear is, wow! That wasn't a part of our plan. You know what I'm saying? But I got to act like this is our normal shit. I got to be like, word. We bust shots in the crib, nigga. Like, what's going on? And I'm seeing the smoke from... I'm seeing the smoke come from his dresser, and then I'm seeing the smoke come from Pone's gun. So I'm like, oh, and in my mind, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? But then we hard. We trying to be like the NWA. This is it.
Well, Sasha was genuinely shook. Right. Like that, like, we knew we was faking, but he, to him, that might have been the gangsterest shit in his life thus far.
Right.
Yo,
shot in the crib.
First of all, he thought the coke was real. We was like, yo, taste it. Like, we knew he wasn't going to taste it. Trash put it on his finger, hit it one time.
Right. I'm about to drop a major bomb on you. First of all, Capone and Noriega, I love you guys. We're all from Queens. The way they describe me in that whole scenario, I mean, a lot of blunts have been smoked in those years since. But I grew up in that neighborhood. I grew up, again, Astoria. Projects and Queensbridge Projects weren't always on the same page, but we are cousins. We're blocks away from each other. So I grew up in that neighborhood. I went to the same school as Nas. No, I'm not some random, quote-unquote, Herb who is so shook. But let me explain to you guys, particularly Capone and Nori, let me explain to you guys how it went down. And Traj, hopefully you're listening, and maybe this will help you remember it in a different way. And I understand you have, like, a young modern journal, quote unquote, journalist from Vibe who's like, yeah, son, yo, what happened, son? Like, yo, son, let me tell you what happened. It's 1996, and I pitch a story about the Queensbridge housing projects because I'm from Queens and I know the importance of the Queensbridge housing projects with so much talent coming out of there, including Nas at the time, Tragedy, of course, one of the greats, Capone and Noriega, half of the group coming out of there, Poet and Hot Day. There's so many, the list goes on and on. Marley Marl, of course. But again, I'm going to stress that Marley made his first track in my building, Queensbridge. But anyway, so I'm doing a story. You know, I could walk there, you know, and I interviewed all these people. Like, I'm not going to say who. Someone had a gun in his closet, like a broom, like a some kind of shotgun. He just opened the, he wasn't even trying to scare. He just happened to open his closet to put something in it. And there was just a gun, like, leaning up against the interior of the closet like it was a broom. Okay. I grew up in the same... I get it. Like, people have guns. Was I a thug? No. Like, again, when people started selling crack, I was the weirdo in the hood who wrote graffiti and had a skateboard and knew white kids out of the neighborhood. So if that means that I'm not, like, a real gangsta, then at 44, having not been shot and having not been through the system for things that we know systematically have been set for us, very obvious traps. And I'm not saying I'm better than anyone else because there's a lot of temptation and dysfunction in our community. And I'm very lucky that I avoided a lot of stuff. But bringing it back to the story that my dear friends relayed, I got the assignment and then it was time
to hire a photographer, George Pitts, who's an amazing photo director at Vibe. He's like, I'm going to hire a photographer. Do you think you can go with him? Because he's British and it's the projects. And, you know, I was like, of course. So, you know, the photographer is a brother from England, but he's from England. So we're walking around and we go to, I guess they already said it was Capone's house. So we go to Capone's house. And did I see guns? 100%. Did I see something that they were, you know, may or may not have been cocaine that was bagged up like cocaine? 100%. Did I put my nose in it and sniff it? No, that's not my job. Now, you have to fucking think, guys, well, you're fronting. Like, if it's not real coke and I'm not saying, hey, can I test it? And you're fucking performing for me like it is real, that's on you. To me, one might refer to that as fronting. Now, mind you, these dudes are all thugs and in the streets and doing all kinds of shit. So I'm not, by no means am I saying these guys are soft, but I'm saying, come on, guys, we're grown ass men. Let's really look back at what happened. Okay. So you're posing. I know for the fact that the guns are real. They didn't look like squirt guns. And I know I've never handled a kilo of cocaine, but if it's bagged up like it's a kilo of cocaine and you're running like it is cocaine, then I guess maybe I'll take your word for it. But then when the guns come out, I said, dudes, straight up, you don't have to do this. You don't have to do this. You sure you want to do this? You don't want to, you don't have to do this, bro. Like, I don't know if it's smart to do this. Do you want to do this? You sure? No, we got this, son. Whatever, whatever. So there's a shot of, you know, one of the rappers there, you know, with a silver briefcase and a shotgun and a coffee pot, clear one with what may or may not be cocaine. That's on you, guys. I told you maybe you shouldn't do it. Did a gun go off? Yeah, I think so. Did I probably jump? Fuck yeah. Yeah. Does that somehow, and see, and that kind of brings me around to some of the fucking conversations that I feel like we need to have. Watching it, I actually showed my wife. I was like, hey, look at this. People are blowing me up about this. And she's like, that's funny. Like that maybe you jumped because a gun went off.
She's like, indoors, that's, yeah, we should say.
That's actually fucking ignorant. And quote me on that. Like, maybe I did jump. If that makes me a pussy, guys, so be it. But then if that actually makes me a pussy, let's think about how we relate to one another in the inner city and how we judge one another based on some of the most fucking stupid, asinine, ignorant things. So yes, let's just say a gun went off and yes, I jumped. I think Capone or Noriega said, oh shit. I said, oh shit, this shit's crazy. Like, yeah, it is crazy. And as a matter of fact, I told you guys, yo, maybe you don't want to do this. Regardless, they went on to say, hey, we're trying to get on in hip hop. So we trying to make this shit pop a certain way. So yeah, so we lied to, you know, the reporter. He's not sophisticated enough that it's not to know. Like, no, I don't do cocaine. You said it was coke. I took your word for it. I didn't fucking put it on my gums and see if it tingled. No, I didn't. So maybe that doesn't make me a real journalist. I don't know. Point is, after that happens, there are a lot of people there. Somebody on the team snitched, okay? And Capone went fucking back to fucking jail because somebody snitched. I don't see Capone for years. And I'm thinking like, oh shit, these motherfuckers think that I somehow snitched or some shit. And I'm at some Notorious B.I.G. memorial dinner, ironically enough, and I see Capone for the first time in God knows how many years. So I'm thinking to myself, oh, I don't know how this is going to, you know, I don't know what this is going to be about. He pulled me to the side and said, yo, I know you didn't snitch. It was Son who snitched. And he knows who I'm talking about. He's like, so-and-so, so-and-so's cousin snitched. And that's why I went back to jail. So again, guys, thank you for shouting me out. Queens all day. Love Capone. Love Noriega. Love Traj. We're all elder statesmen in the game right now. Much respect. I know you remember the story that way. Here's how I remember it. I feel like it's unfortunate that things went down the way it did. It's unfortunate that a young black man went back to jail because Capone had already been in jail at a very young age. You can ask him what he was in jail for. He had already been in jail and had a budding career, and he went back to jail because dudes were fronting. And if there was never a photograph of dudes with guns and quote-unquote cocaine that I wasn't sophisticated enough to know about, motherfuckers wouldn't have gone to jail. So I haven't gone to jail, for what it's worth. And Capone and Noriega, let's think about the people who come after us. And let's think about when we tell stories in the media, what we say and how we say it and how it reflects on us. And I commend you on sort of talking about how, you know, you, I can see in how you're saying it. It's like, yeah, this is mad juvenile and stupid and haha, you're laughing about it. But like, not everything is funny. And it really wouldn't have been funny if someone would have gotten hurt that day. It's really sad that someone had to go back to jail. And it's even more sad that the fire in me is out, because what I'm doing is a reflection of the insecurities we have in the hood. And here I am trying to fucking explain why making that kind of statement is silly. And here I am trying to defend myself. I had people saying like, yo, son, you was shook. Like, if the gun went off in the apartment, yeah, I would be shook. And anyone with half a fucking brain should be shook. And why am I crazy for feeling that way?
Yeah.
So there you go. You weren't expecting all that, but Queens all day, guys.
Definitely. And, you know, move ahead to Fresh Dressed, your documentary, just aired on CNN. One of the early sections in it happens right at the beginning, focuses on the idea of the Sunday best and the history of the Sunday best. And kind of the disturbing history in some ways behind that concept.
The term Sunday best came from a time in slavery when, in order for slave owners to be considered good Christians, they had to make sure that their slaves had at least one good outfit so that they would go to church on Sunday, even though most of them were practicing other African indigenous religions.
Why was going all the way back to that, to essentially slavery times, a crucial starting point for you to tell your story?
Because clothing, particularly for African Americans and folks of color in America, is a reflection of where they are in society. And when you go back and think that the idea of Sunday best, you ask anyone today, what does Sunday best mean? Anyone will tell you, oh, it just means you wear nice clothes to church. And that's what happens in America. Words start out meaning one thing and then it turns into, you know, a whole other idea. But when I learned that Sunday best meant that in particular states, you know, it was mandated that slave owners had to buy their slaves one nice outfit so they can go to church. Like, when you think about that, it's like, first of all, it's a whole new faith system that has nothing to do with where they come from in Africa. Second of all, here's this whole new style of clothing that is not indigenous to them that they are now forced to wear. And then I thought about growing up in the hood, and me and Nas talk about this store, BJ Boots, which was close to Queensbridge, you know, in Long Island City. Like, that was the place that you went to get the fly shit. You went to BJ Boots and you begged your mother, and she 90% of the time didn't have the money, but she found it. And for those whose mothers couldn't find it, they sold drugs. But you went to BJ Boots, or you went to QP's, and that's where you bought your clothes. And I remember, you know, I tell the story all the time. My mom was the Haitian lady who would rather me go to Macy's and buy me three expensive pair of corduroy pants that would last me, you know, 10 years and have me, quote unquote, dress up, as opposed to dressing like a bum or dressing like all the other kids. And I'll never forget, like, I finally convinced my mother. It's like, yo, I can't be a Herb anymore. I've got to wear what everyone else is wearing. And that pressure became more intense around Easter time, because in New York and in the hood everywhere, like, you have Easter break and you have to come back fresh. Like, if you didn't come back fresh from Easter, like, you were made fun of. So every kid wants to feel like they're a part of something. Every kid wants to feel like they're a participant and that they're accepted. And so I'll never forget that Easter break when my mom finally broke down. She took me to BJ Boots or QP's, which was like a swap meet equivalent in Queens. Anyone from Queens knows what QP's is if they're an OG. And then I remember coming back to the block. I remember my mother saying, like, wow, this is so much cheaper than Macy's. Like, great, you have enough clothes to last you weeks. And I'll never forget walking back to my building, and the park was like to the side of my building. And kids are like, yo, you went shopping? Like, yeah. I was like, yo, I got these Pumas. Yo, come down with them. You know what I mean? I was like, all right, I'm going to put my shit on. And I went upstairs. And I put on one of my, it was probably like some Lee colored Lee twill jeans and like whatever else in these gray suede quarter high Pumas. And I remember coming downstairs and being like, I'm the fucking man. And everyone's like, yo, those sneakers are cool. Nobody has those. And so there, that remembering that feeling of like the acceptance and then the importance and then remembering the people who couldn't afford it and then remembering what the people who couldn't afford it did to get it. I felt like connecting slavery and going from slavery to the South Bronx, which looked like World War II Poland in the late 60s, early 70s, making that connection to how clothing was a reflection of who we were and how we reacted to society by the way we dressed. And you look at the gangs, they wanted to be Hell's Angels. They couldn't be Hell's Angels because they weren't white.
This was something we talked to Benji Melendez about when we had him on the show, that he, you know, very explicitly, to the point where he literally got in trouble with the Hell's Angels, designed the Ghetto Brothers look after the Hell's Angels.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Hell's Angels is a fraternity. They have their rules and their laws. That's their right. It's America. But kids in the inner city were really inspired by them. They were iconic. You know, you had all these films. You had Easy Rider. You had all kinds of...
The sort of hidden influence, secret influence of Easy Rider is another thing that pops up in the film that was, at least even to me, a little surprising.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's just Easy Rider. It's just the idea of how iconic biker gangs had become, and that Easy Rider, which came out in 69, was the culmination of like all of these things happening. And then you think about Altamont, which people will say is the death of the 60s, and the Hell's Angels had a heavy hand in what went down at Altamont. You know, it's a reflection of, if you go from Easy Rider to Altamont to the South Bronx was Altamont. It was people stabbing each other. It was people dressing in particular way. It was rough and tumble. And so hip hop was inspired by that, or early hip hop. It wasn't, you know, weren't calling it hip hop at that point, but gang culture gave birth to hip hop, and that's how gang culture identified itself. It's how it dressed itself. It was inspired by biker gangs.
Yeah. And, you know, more of a filmmaking question, someone who's at least around filmmakers, your editor on the film, not a fan of hip hop, knew next to nothing. I mean, you know, from what you've said, next to nothing about hip hop. Why was that important in making the film? I think you mentioned that turned out to be a benefit.
Oh, that was great. I mean, you know, I'm making a film ultimately for CNN. You know, CNN Films financed it. And, you know, they have a films division. They want their films to get into Sundance. They want their films to get in Toronto. There's no guarantees your film is going to get into any of these places. There's no guarantee that this film financed by CNN is going to get picked up by a distributor. So if nothing were to happen with the film theatrically, which, you know, for a documentary is already slim, you know, it's got to air on CNN. So if it's going to air on CNN, you're dealing with middle America. You're dealing with people who know nothing about hip hop at all. So having an editor who had all these questions, you know, questions that someone who knows nothing about hip hop would have definitely put us in a position to create something. I mean, it's easy for me to know what the insider is going to appreciate. Like, yeah, I got fucking Thurston Howell, Lowlifes. Like, if you know about the Lowlifes, like, wow. And I saw on Twitter, like, people were watching the film and be like, okay, you got so-and-so, but, you got Thurston Howell, but they're not going to have Dapper Dan. It was like all of these things, like, for people who are on the inside,
yeah,
who really know, like, oh, okay. So I'm on the inside. Like, I know who's who. I know who's important. You can't squeeze everyone in 82 minutes, but I know who's who. So I know what it's going to take to make the core people or the people who are into hip hop say, okay, I respect this. He's touching on things that are important. But Andy, the editor, she is going to be able to open me up to the questions that need to be answered for people who know nothing. So that's why I feel like the film is a great balance of speaking to the core and being true to the culture, but also speaking to an audience that knows nothing about it and bridging the gap and bringing those audiences together in a way that to me is Ego Trip. It's like, well, it's what we did with Ego Trip. It's just like finding something that's really interesting and fascinating to us and finding a way to bring more people to the party while being true to what that thing is that we're fascinated by.
Yeah, I thought that was something the film was really successful at, it, you know, appealing to everyone. But at the same time, you have, like you said, these signifiers of inside knowledge. You have Jamel Shabazz, you know, you have a Thurston Howell, you talk about the Ghetto Brothers and so forth. So, you know, one or two more things about Fresh Dress. There's this moment where you actually have Pusha T say it, but, you know, you talk about Eminem's clothing company, not only by itself, but it's kind of a metonym for rappers, clothing companies that appeared to be more of a cash grab than come out of any interest in fashion.
You weren't going to wear Shady. Just were not. I mean, there's nothing that made you think that Shady was, you know, into fashion. You know, as a consumer, you sort of just knew it was a money play.
You know, his company kind of stood in for a bunch of others. You know, you talk about Outkast or whatever, maybe a few others. But mentioning, you know, the Shady Limited particularly, was there any pushback on that? Especially because, as you mentioned, like, you had written his book and presumably had some contacts.
Yeah,
in the camp.
Shady people are not happy with me, and I probably somehow burned a bridge. Eminem has come out against albums he's made and said that he doesn't like the album. This time around is different. Them last two albums didn't count. Encore, I was on drugs. Relapse, I was flushing them out. I've come to make it up to you now. No more fucking around. I got something to prove to fans because I feel like I let them down. So please accept my... Eminem is one of the greatest writers, hip-hop, and performers hip-hop has ever known. I don't know that clothing is high on his agenda. You know, as an artist, I don't know that a clothing line is going to somehow, or a not so successful clothing line, or I'm sure it was successful for a time and made money. I don't know that that commentary on that clothing line is going to somehow hurt him. And as a matter of fact, you know, I know that they're not, you know, the Shady folks are not happy with me. I don't know if Shady himself isn't happy with me, but, you know, I monitored social media when the film aired, and no one said anything about it. No one said, ha, 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 Eminem, blah, blah, blah. No one said anything. So Outkast is another group that I've done extensive. I've done a lot of stuff with Outkast. They had a clothing line. It's not here anymore. They were part of a trend. Eminem's big, and so is Outkast. These are people who, as a journalist, I've covered. And that's not going to change. If I'm doing something and I'm telling a story, I'm going to go with the strongest examples of subjects or things in a category. And because Eminem is one of the strongest subjects in terms of his importance to his contributions to hip hop lyrically and musically, yes, you know, pointing out that he had a clothing line helps to really sell the idea on how successful that end of the business was for a time. I mean, M, you're the man. Everyone else is shady. I don't know what to say. I mean, I wish everyone the best. Can't be friends with everyone. And at this stage in my life, you know, I feel it's important to have strong opinions. Or I feel it's not even about having strong opinions. It's if I have a platform to say things, I'm going to say them. So,
yeah. And, you know, finally about the film, you did most of your press run for it with Dapper Dan.
Mm-hmm. Daniel Dapper Dan Day ran his eponymous store in Harlem during the 1980s and 90s. He gained fame for creating designer-branded products that the actual companies weren't making. His jackets, car interiors, sneakers, and other products were beloved by rappers like Eric B. and Rakim, Salt-N-Pepa and the Fat Boys, athletes like Mike Tyson, and gangsters. Incidentally, we met Dan at an event in Harlem recently, and he just may be the nicest and best-dressed human being on the planet.
Why him as opposed to, you know, the 79 or who other people you interviewed?
I don't know if it was a conscious decision by me. I think that folks behind the scenes with the film, the distributor, CNN, people just gravitated to Dan in the film.
Having met him, I can see why.
Yeah, I mean, him saying, I blackenized it.
Anything that a designer didn't have, I would embellish it for them, you know? I blackenized it. You know, I made it so that it'll look good on us.
It's like whenever I'm in a room, you know, I can't always sit through the film. I've seen it a few times at this point. But like if I'm standing outside of the room and I'm looking in and I know that that moment's coming up, I know I'm going to hear laughs. It happens every time. for me, it was a real treat because he's, you know, my dad, if he was around, would have been around his age. And, you know, his experiences as an African-American in America, like, for instance, like, he pulled me to the side and be like, yo, the way you talk to these people, you know, like, it's kind of, you know, he's from a different time. He's not used to seeing someone like myself speaking with people in a very particular way. And I'm not even saying I'm speaking with people in a bad way or in a tough way. It's just in a very confident way, especially when I'm talking about things that I'm creating. So being able to talk to Dan about what his life was like coming up in Harlem when he did and all the amazing stories for me made me feel really good knowing that he was in the film because he's an important part of the link. Not only for hip hop, for New York, for Harlem, you know, telling the gentrification story, telling so many different stories, telling the stories of like coming from the South, you know, having family members from the South. Or he told me stories about how Harlem was comprised by the strongest minds from every Southern state came to Harlem, you know, and he was like, these are the guys that I learned from, you know, it was like, so-and-so, Pookie, who lived around the corner, he's from South Carolina, but he was the strongest mind in South Carolina. That's why he's here. And so when he talks about the just in-between interviews, like having the opportunity to hear about all these stories about Harlem and, you know, the culture of sharing and helping one another was an important idea in the film that I wanted to share with people. And that's not so prevalent anymore. And so having someone who epitomizes this culture of like, I have this community. It's like so many people like, yeah, when Dame Dash said, yeah, he should have had his own clothing line and he should have had his own brand. But when Dan very simply in the film says, I just wanted to serve my community. I just wanted love up here. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with having like a really successful business in your own community and serving them? He just wanted to serve his community. He's from a different time. He wasn't thinking about being in Macy's. That wasn't really a possibility for guys from his era. So to see people connecting with Dan and appreciating Dan and saying, yo, Dan, you did all these amazing things. Like, these people owe you. And seeing his energy and how he's just wants to give back. That's all he ever really wanted to do. I mean, he wanted to sell Gucci and Louis and all these things legitimately, but because he was just some black guy in Harlem, oh no, we're not going to sell to him. So he took matters into his own hands. And to me, that's what hip hop is. Hip hop is, you don't see yourself reflected in popular culture or in the things that you like. And so you want that reflection. You want to see yourself in that reflection. And that's what Dan did.
And I mean, there's so much more I could talk to you about. We didn't even get into hardcore, the heavy metal list book you did and right. Like a whole bunch of stuff. But, you know, one final thing. You know, something that's come up a few times on the show with different people, you know, Michael Holman, a whole bunch of different people. You were in New York City, although you were pretty young, when a couple different forms of expression of youth culture kind of melded into this thing that came to be called hip hop. Looking back on it now, you know, what do you think about that process? Do you kind of look back on when you were a kid and see that, you know, retrospectively having happened? Like,
yeah, I mean, to me, it's who I am today. You know, all of those ideas coming together and interesting, unique people coming together from different boroughs, different perspectives to create and express themselves. I mean, if you look at hip hop, you know, again, it started in parks. You know, you look at hardcore music, you know, obviously there's a UK punk movement. And before that, you know, you have the MC5 and the Stooges, and you can go as far back as Blue Cheer if you want to. But it's do it yourself. You know, hip hop is do it yourself. You know, hardcore is do it yourself. Graffiti is do it yourself. And for me as a kid who wanted to do it himself, I gravitated towards all of these things. You know, I saw zines in hardcore and then I saw zines in graffiti and there weren't too many graffiti zines. So then I bridged that. And then, you know, I probably wanted to be a rapper when I was a kid. I think I had some raps that weren't that good. But then I found other ways to be involved with hip hop, documenting it. You know, graffiti got me into documenting things. And then I went from a graffiti magazine to to a hip hop magazine. New York at that time was desperate. And in desperate times, people get creative because what else are you going to do? There weren't so many distractions, you know. I think New York has always been a city of transients, but I also know that there were generations of people who were here for a long time. And I think that because of money and technology and all these things, you know, New York is just, now it's just lots of different people from different places. And I think me coming up when I did, it wasn't so much that. And so there was a lot of local culture that got to stew and boil. And when it was time for an explosion, there were enough people who were ready to receive the fallout and push each other and do more things. And so, yeah, I mean, I'll always think like, well, what if I would have stayed in Silver Spring, Maryland? Like, what would my life have been? Like, Bad Brains are from DC. Like, would I have been into the Bad Brains if I stayed there? Maybe. But would I have been in a band with Daryl Jennifer? Probably not. You know, would I have gotten into graffiti? Yeah, I knew some graffiti writers in DC. But would I have gotten into it the way I did in New York? Probably not. Would I be in bands? Would I write books? Would I do films? Maybe. But I would have had to have gone to school in Silver Spring to do that. I would have had to have gone straight to college. All the folks I talked about today were all inspirations to me. And I learned something from Chino BYI and Henry Chalfant and Phase 2 and Daryl Jennifer. The list goes on and on. I learned from these people things that I couldn't learn in school. So New York back then was a real learning environment. And I'm not the best at school. I have to do it. Like, if I want to do something and learn it, I have to do it. I'm not formally trained in filmmaking, you know? I took a journalism class at a community college once, you know? I did get a fellowship to the Graduate School of Journalism.
Right.
At Columbia.
Right.
Which kind of made my Haitian mom happy, but she's still asking me, when am I going to graduate from college? You know what I mean? I love her, but she doesn't, you know, fully understand. But the education that I have, I don't have a board certified education, but the education I received on the streets of New York, like, I couldn't pay, you know, thinking about it now, I don't know where you'd be able to learn all the things that I learned anywhere else.
Awesome. Well, we will have to have you back to talk everything else, Super Black and the Wilding incident and White Mandingos and, you know, your music career, which we really hardly
triple platinum now. I'm rich. So much money and groupies in the music industry. It's just, can't talk about that stuff. All the White Mandingos groupies.
Well, Sasha, thank you. Thank you so much, Astoria's Finest, for coming through.
Well, thank you.
As a longtime admirer of a lot of Sasha's work, it was great to be able to sit down with him and find out exactly how he made it all happen. But more importantly, it was cool to get his personal history of hip-hop, hardcore, and graffiti, and to see how his story fit into the larger tale of those art forms. The fact that he ended up collaborating with so many people who started out as influences was very inspiring to hear. And of course, I'm glad that I was able to get his take on that now infamous CNN interview. Next week's artist has changed, so I'm calling in from Brooklyn to let you know what we have coming up. Our next episode will feature Minnesota's finest, Prof. After years of regional stardom, Prof took his patented combination of booze-drenched party anthems and thoughtful emotional events, and his powerful live shows, to the biggest platform in his region, Rhymesayers Records. His brand new album, Liability, is out this week. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
One of you motherfuckers are gonna smoke with Cypress Hill today.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And he was the guy who was supposed to interview and he just falls asleep.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Freestyle, just me asking them, oh, gangs, you know, whatever, you know, I'm from New York.
Special thanks to our biggest Patreon supporter, Vikram.
Why is it so crazy out here?
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
It's fascinating to me who gets money and how much it is and what happens with it and what doesn't happen with it.